call the conversations to a close, but I think I will so that we can get started. I'm Cynthia Molobita, and this is the first of five sessions looking at the foolishness of God and love as a political ecological vocation. So if you didn't plan to be in this session, then this is the time to go find the right plane, I guess. And that's what we're here for the next 5 days. My intent, what I've planned, is for us to work together to explore what could be called the fundamental calling or vocation of Christian life, and that is to love as God loves. The text with which we are all terribly familiar is in Matthew chapter 22. Jesus says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." So we get as the greatest commandments the callings of our life, to love God and to love neighbor as self. The church, for two millennia, and for centuries before that with our Hebrew forebears, has struggled to understand what that means. What does it mean to love neighbor as one loves oneself? And it's terribly perplexing and enormously difficult to figure out. How many of you have spent any time at any point in your life thinking about what does the call to love neighbor mean to me at this particular point? Is it easy or difficult?
Difficult.
Why? What makes it so difficult? Five words. What makes it so difficult? Let me hear something.
What does love mean?
What does love mean? Okay. Because
well,
you know
our
you want
humanness.
To. Our humanness.
Yeah.
The difficulty of loving.
Yeah.
Is that?
Because it's all our self.
Uh-huh.
It's all in the forefront of all our activities.
Oh, how interesting. So you saw, are you Lutheran?
I am.
No, but I'm saying because, I mean, Martin Luther has this incredible understanding of sin. And that is the Latin is se incurvitus in se, which means self-curved in on self.
Right.
Which is just what you were talking about, the propensity to be curved in on our own self-interest. What else makes it difficult?
Well, I think, you know, the difference between knowing and doing.
Oh.
You know, being able to actually make the step of, this, you know, your will, not mine, along the lines of what it's saying. But then actually to do it and say, okay, well, that might mean, it might mean some ramifications for how I live my life. I might have to make changes.
Okay, so the distinction between I might know what's right, but will I do what's right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, has anyone ever encountered that problem? Like every day. One concept that I'd like to work with related to that in these sessions is the concept of moral agency. And moral agency is just a word that is, it sounds a little bit on the technical side from the field of ethics, but it's so powerful. And moral agency really means moral power. The power to do what we understand we ought. Are you with me on that? One of the things I like, and this is coming specifically, oh, what was your name?
Linda.
Let's say our names when we speak, because otherwise I have to call you OU or hey you. One thing to bear in mind is the idea of moral consciousness, and which I think is one of the most important concepts to have in mind in our day and age, and that is the idea of understanding a gap, recognizing a gap between what is and what ought be. So, give me an example of moral consciousness. What's a gap between what is and what ought?
Consuming the poor.
Okay, we ought not consume as much. Or say, what's the gap?
The gap is that we overconsume, which destroys the earth and takes away from other people.
Okay.
Need.
So, the difference between the what is, the overconsumption, and the what ought, sustainable living. You said something else. Okay, a gap between what is and what ought be in our response to poverty.
We know.
Okay, well, some would very good. Some would say that the thing that distinguishes us from the chimpanzee is moral consciousness. And we could talk a lot about what distinguishes us from the chimpanzee. Maybe the chimpanzee has moral consciousness. We could argue that, but that's a fundamental characteristic of the human, moral consciousness. So let's keep that in mind. So we have what is and what ought be. Say, for instance, what is how we do respond to poverty and how we ought. Moral agency really means the capacity, the power to move from what is toward what ought be. Are you with me? So if you just bear in mind that gap and moral agency as the possibility to move toward the way things ought be. I find my husband's in the room, and he's said once that the most important word in the English language, words are prepositions. And you might notice something interesting in what I said. I didn't say the power to move from what is to what ought be. Did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't say that, because if we thought we had to have the power to get to where things ought to be, we can give up in hopelessness and defeat. So the word toward is a very powerful preposition to keep in mind. So one of my, and this is again, Linda, you brought up this idea of what I'm describing as moral agency. One of my intents for our time together is for us to nurture a sense of hope and of moral agency regarding, well, moral agency for living toward a world that is more just and ecologically sustainable. It seems to me that one of the most important challenges facing the North American people is the development of moral agency to live, well, all people, but to live toward where we ought in this world in which the ecological crisis, for one, is so profound. Well, anyway, I was asking you, we'll get off track a lot, because I do want this to be our discussion, so we won't follow a real rigid text here. I warn you of that, because my students always say, why don't you just say what you were going to say in line and don't respond to our questions. So I was asking you, why is it so difficult to grapple with this idea of love neighbor as self? One of the things that we didn't mention but probably would, as others spoke, would be, who is my neighbor? You know, and what if I'm called to love my students by dealing with their, spending my evening grading their papers, that's serving their well-being, but I'm also called to love my kids by helping them with their paper that they're writing. You know, love can pull you in two different ways, and how do you discern which way to move, and who is my neighbor? I think another reason why it's so difficult, the reason you could say what God calls us to do is to love, and why is it so difficult? I think another reason is because it's so situational. In other words, love calls us to different things in different situations. Love called me to treat my child in a certain way when he needed something. Love called me to treat him in a certain way when he was 6 months old. It was meet his need. When he's 21 years old and he's hungry, the response of love isn't the same thing. You know, it might be make your own sandwich. Or what about Jesus? Can you think of examples of where love meant something different in different contexts? Think about that for a minute. Yes.
Healing the sick and the crippled on the one hand, and overturning the tables in the temple on the other.
Oh, okay. So in one spot, he's in this incredible compassion of healing, and in the other spot, he's violently, and I'm not saying with killing and bloodshed and all, but he's with great
anger
and energy, he's driving people out of the temple, and as we understand with the whip. Other examples of where love meant something different in different contexts. Is that the Stitcher's hand going up?
No.
It went up, but
just don't scratch your head.
You can't think of any other examples. Just think to yourself. Any? Yes.
Well, like how he accepts the adulteress, but rebukes the Pharisees.
Okay. Both are doing something wrong from the standpoint of his moral law. And he sharply rebukes one, and the other is, he's gently accepting of a different voice. Okay.
When I'm thinking about that as well, for me, and I'm applying my, how do I love my neighbor? I think what Jesus is leading us as an example, it's easy to love the ones you already love. He's calling us to love the ones that may not be so easy to love. That it's hard for us to accept, to understand, to know those are the ones we're supposed to actively work towards loving, because it's not easy.
Okay, so I love the person that betrayed me.
I love the person who, me personally, I've been in a lot of outrage about the war and politics. How can I, but these are my neighbors too, people making these decisions. I can sit there and well, they do this and they do that.
Okay.
They're also my neighbor. I have to find some point of compassion there as well.
Okay.
It's hard to do.
Okay. Very, very good. Very good. What is a proper response of love is so contextual. Yes.
But did Christ say love your enemy? That's not very easy to do.
Okay. To take that seriously is an extraordinarily dramatic thing to think of. Yes.
In our culture, oftentimes when we want to show love and to help, we're looking through our eyes rather than their needs. Oftentimes they are not always the same.
Okay, now that's a lovely example of we may try to help, and it's misguided help. It's misguided help because we didn't really understand the situation. Very, very good point. Yes.
And like the woman at the well, where Jesus talks to her and tells her her history, and it conveys that sense of love to her.
Okay. And conveys it in a very different way than he may have conveyed love at another time. Yeah. Can you think of a time when you have not loved well, even though you wanted to, because you didn't understand the situation, the context?
I can think of times when I was working as a paramedic, and I had patients who were just repulsive to me. And, you know, I found it very hard to be loving, even though I was taking care of them. I was rejecting them at some level.
Okay.
And that's not what's in Matthew 20:22.
So interesting, and yet you were in another sense loving them by caring for them.
Right.
Yeah. Good. Let me think again for just a time when it was the misreading of the situation or not knowing fully what was going on that caused you to love in not well. Yes.
I'm Steve.
Yes. Thank you.
I found myself at times to be in severe emotional distress myself, and then on reflection did not have the ability to think through and have the correct loving response, although I tried.
Okay, very good. You probably didn't have the ability to see enough, to understand the situation enough to understand how to respond. What about when a person is in great distress? And I mean, let's just be very simplistic, and comes to you and they're strangling. They can't breathe. Well, it would be good to find out before you figure out what to do, why they can't breathe. Is it do they have a hornet sting that's choking up their throat and therefore you need to give them their little syringe? Or can they not breathe because they were choking? So finding out what's happening is important before we respond.
Cindy?
Yes.
When we had our interim pastor, when we had our interim pastor, he taught us a lot about how anxiety can make us do things that we think are loving and giving. Like say someone's father died or husband or whatever, and the church might want to bring food to that person and shower them with attention and everything. That might not be what they need, but that's what we're anxious about. We think we're being loving, but we haven't really assessed.
You haven't assessed what the person really needs. Very good. Very good. Smart pastor. I would just suggest that to love well, and we'll talk more about what love means, but to love well really does require us to figure out what's happening, to figure out what the needs are. to figure out what the problem is so that we can serve the well-being of the suffering, which is a fundamental part of what love means. What we are going to do in these sessions is try to think about what love means in the contemporary context in which we live and breathe. The contemporary context that is probably some of the most life-influencing realities that we exist in. And one is the ecological crisis. And the other is the growing gap between rich and poor in our world. Did you recently, a study came up from the United Nations that says that approximately 225 people on Earth have wealth equal to half of humankind. And for many of that half, poverty means death. Poverty is death by poverty. It's a stunning kind of a fact. I want, one of the questions that has haunted me, literally, in my life is, what does it mean to be living in this world today, causing global warming? We produce 150 times as many greenhouse gases as some of our counterparts in other parts of the world do. And yet we won't suffer from it most. The people who are suffering first and most are low-lying regions whose lands are being flooded out, people who aren't protected as we are to the extent that we are from the dangers of natural disasters, like the poor in New Orleans suffered from those who had. And what does it mean to have so much? And we'll talk more about this, but the question that I struggle with is, what does it mean to love in this context? My work in pulling together these sessions for us really grows out, and I want to say something about who I am so you know what you're getting yourself into. My work around this grows really out of, how many of you are Lutherans? A lot of you are Lutherans. You remember Luther League? Yeah. What I'm doing right now grows out of my Luther League experience. And in Luther League, I was a district officer or something, and we saw a film. And I am not sure what the name of that film was. I think it was Guess Who's Coming to Breakfast. But it showed us what happens in order to get a breakfast meal at our table. And what people basically were terribly exploited to get the cereal and the sugar and the orange juice, et cetera, to our table. And I was about, my best recollection is I was probably 14, and it just devastated me. I had been brought up to believe that we care about our neighbors. You know, we care about people in other countries. And I saw this sharp, sharp film, and I thought, what does this mean? And it set me on a course of digging more and more into international relations and how, where we get our wealth. But, so that's part of where I'm coming from, that film. And then I spent 2 years as a missionary in Honduras. And there, I worked with nutrition, education, and rehabilitation. So malnourished kids, and I would see why they were hungry. They weren't hungry because their parents were lazy. They were hungry because their parents couldn't grow food because the land was owned elsewhere, maybe by Black Angus cows, the cows didn't own it, but Black Angus companies, the land they couldn't get to. And therefore, little babies were born and died, 3 months later, which is very simplified. I'm simplifying 2 years worth of learning in Honduras. But I saw that I left Honduras. I realized my job wasn't to work with people there. My job was to work with people in my country to help alter things so that their lives wouldn't suffer from various international economic arrangements. But again, that's part of where I'm coming from, that experience as a missionary. And then I spent about 8 years working for the Center for Global Education at Oxford College. Familiar to anybody? Mm-hmm. I ran their East Coast office and brought delegations of people to Latin America. They were newspaper editors and farmers and priests and students and longshoremen and Wall Street lawyers and homemakers, all kinds of people. But it was years of listening to a wide variety of people in Latin America. And again, I realized that something isn't right, that the descendants of the tribes of Europe have so much, and the descendants of the tribes of Africa and South America and Australia basically don't. And it had to do with 500 years of the way we related to each other. So that's where I'm coming from. And after that, I went to study in seminary and do graduate work, and all I wanted to study was theology and issues of more social justice, and that was to do theological ethics. So that's what I did, and that's what I'm teaching in now. And that's what motivates a lot of what I'm doing and what I'm doing right here. I'd like to start the rest of the evening with a story, and I'd like you just to listen to it. But before we do, I need to ask you to trust that this story is both beautiful and horrible. And I want you to just trust that we're not ending these sessions in the horribleness. We're ending these sessions with a sense of hope and, as I said, moral agency. But I want to start with a story that doesn't have such a good, at least midpoint, at which I'll end it right now. So if you could take a minute just to sit back, and you can close your eyes, or you can just sit and open your eyes. Those are the only two options with your eyes. Okay, someone in the back is opening one and closing the other. Okay. Begin with imagining. Imagine, if you will, a world of splendor and abundance beyond imagining. A dawn every 24 hours, sun called forth from deep indigo of sky. Songbirds in myriad voices sing with abandon. They are the voice of beauty. Fragrance wafts from living beings in infinite shapes and colors and sizes, from the tiniest, most delicate blossoms to exotic, voluptuous, deep purples. Drops of glistening water powder the land at the birth of each day. The air shimmers with fluttering leaves. Light rays dance all over. Everywhere is breath. Life is birthing. Luscious fruits hang from trees. In the soil, hardy grains emerge. Dusk comes. Indigo of yet another shade deepens. In that cycle, the creatures receive regular rest. In this fecund circle of life, all that dies becomes sustenance for other creatures and elements. The weave of interdependence is breathtaking. Beyond full comprehension, a radiant ball of energy from eons past issues energy sufficient to meet the needs of all life forms. What one gives off sustains the other. Birth, death, days and planets, creatures and colors are born and die and bring new life. Decaying log nurses her young. Complexity and simplicity unite. Cycles of death and resurrection. And trees watching and hearing and guiding, sheltering. It is a wild, raucous, birthing, fire-spewing, earth-quaking communion of life, joined in the hymn of all creation, as we say in our liturgy, praising the source and sustainer of their being. The splendor of this world is exceeded by one thing only. That is the radiant love of its creator, embracing the creation and coursing through it. This world is beloved with, in the words of one of my favorite medieval mystics, love as a burning fire that will never cease in all the endless ages to come. In this world's most recent moments, appear creatures of particular consciousness, self-aware, temporally and spatially. They are able to reflect on the world and their place in it, to wonder and to create. As all the other creatures and elements, these human mud creatures is the word that one of my favorite second century theologians calls Adam and Eve, the mud creatures. These mud creatures are crafted from the dust of long past stars. They are fashioned as community, in community, by community, and for community. They depend for life itself on a web of interrelated beings and elements. The hundreds of unseen organisms living in and on their bodies. The thousands of organisms in a foot of soil, the trees of the Amazon rainforest. The Holy One reveals to the human ones who claim to be in the image of their Creator their life work. They are called not only to praise God, but to love. Receiving the gracious love of their God, they are to trust it, and then to live that mysterious and marvelous love into the world. Forever, beloved, they are to be intentional bearers of that love. The work of the people, the liturgia, is to receive God's gift of life-saving love, allow it to abide in them, and in the entire allow it to abide in them, and in them work toward abundant life for all. They are created to be lovers, offering to God, self and others, and the entire creation, the love that they are fed by the one who gives them life. For so doing, they are given in the image of the Holy One hearts of infinite compassion, love that sustains one another. This, then, is the oikos, the household of God. The Holy One, the light and water of this vast communion, hungering for its well-being, gave to the species called human guidelines for household management. Oikonomia is the Greek, a combination of oikos for household and nomos for law. Oikonomia, economy in the English. The Holy One gave the human ones these guidelines, oikonomia, and the intelligence to develop the guidelines in multiple ways as the complexity of social life unfolds. The oikonomia, the economy, was grounded in one firm foundation, loving neighbor as self. Thus, Earth's bounty was to be shared. None would have too much where it cast the others into want. The Holy One, quoting from Deuteronomy, set before the human ones life and death, blessings and curses, and commanded them to choose life, so that you and your descendants may live. Deuteronomy 30:19. They have chosen death. Unknowingly, unintentionally, unwittingly, blindly, they have chosen for the living world death. They alone now threaten Earth's capacity to sustain life as we know and love it. That unprecedented moral crisis is accompanied by another, produced by many of the same political economic dynamics. We have created and are deepening a morally reprehensive gap between those who have too much and those who have not enough for life or for life with dignity. Every day, more children die of poverty and human-related causes, hunger-related causes, than died in the Twin Towers disaster. But the world does not have a food shortage. In grain alone, let alone our other sources of food, in grains alone, we have enough to provide every person on Earth with adequate calories daily. That does not even include the fruits, vegetables, legumes, fish, and grass-fed meat on the planet. The problem is not inadequate food available. The problem is people too poor to get it. So hear it slowly, what I said a moment ago. According to a recent UN report, 225 of us now possess wealth equal to 47% of the human family. Mm-hmm. And for many, poverty means death. Mm-hmm. You can open your eyes, and I asked you to promise to trust me that we're not ending the story there. But that's where I want to end it for this moment, for our conversation at this moment. Because considered theologically, this twofold crisis vaults us into completely unprecedented, unfamiliar terrain. No human beings have ever faced what we now face. an unsustainable relationship with the planet. Never before have people been in a relationship with the planet that the planet can't sustain. Our parents and grandparents couldn't teach us how to deal with this. I look at my undergrad students and I look at them and I think, this is the generation. Some of you are that generation in this room. This is the generation that decides or not. But in more truth, this generation and my generation, the people living in this room, these generations, our little ones, our wee little ones, Anna's baby, others of you who have babies, it will be decided by the time they're old enough to decide. It's a horrible burden for the younger generation to bear because you didn't really create it. You inherited what the ones before you did or set in motion. But the point also is that theologically, I think it poses a mind-boggling reality. And I'll tell you about that. I discovered this about a year and a half ago. I learned from a German theologian, a highly respected theologian, who's also a biblical scholar, that the word for good in the creation story, the Hebrew word is tov. Remember when God created, God said it was good. That word tov, more accurately, is translated as life furthering. So each, God does this and God does that, and then God says it is life furthering. Well, the fundamental reality in the ecological crisis is the earth can go on. It's the life-generating capacity that we're threatening. We're threatening the animals and plants' capacity to continue sustaining life. In other words, we're undoing it is good. Do you hear what I'm saying? God said it was life-furthering, and all of a sudden the species comes along, and that's that life-furthering quality that we're undoing, which seems to me, if that was creating, we're uncreating. Mm. And what does it mean to be doing the opposite of the thing that we, you know, the first thing we say God did is create. So theologically, it's rather mind-boggling. Is that what we're doing? Are we being the uncreators in the face of our God who created? So that's why I think it's a theological issue as well as a very practical issue. It seems to me that in this context, something completely new is asked of humankind. Never has humankind been faced again with this, faced before with this dilemma. There's an old Chinese proverb, or an ancient Chinese proverb that says, if things continue as they are, if we do not change direction, we will end up where we are headed. I think it speaks volumes to us today. Human society of the future, if there is to be one for this dangerous species, will have changed direction. We will have forged ways of living that planet Earth can sustain and that do not build a gap between those who can survive and those who die from poverty. If we survive as a species, we will have, by definition, we will have created a sustainable relationship with the planet. When something new is asked of humankind, something new is asked of religion. It seems to me that all of Earth's great faith traditions today are called to plumb our depths for moral and spiritual wisdom to make this shift. Science isn't going to do it alone. It's going to take, you know, for 1,000 years, theology and philosophy reigned on the throne of knowledge, and then with modernity, we get science reigning. Well, today in our world, sciences and theological wisdom, religious wisdom, have to come together. So a task of religions is to plumb our depths for the wisdom to meet this crisis. It's interesting how much the scientific world is calling upon religion in these days to join hands. I could cite you a number of documents in many instances. I wonder then, how do we think about that as Christians? What does this situation say about what it means to be Christ's body on earth, charged with loving and with tending creation? In this situation, what does it mean? What do we bring to the table as Christians? We must bring something. Otherwise, would we have been entrusted with tending creation? I want you to think for just a minute and just do a quick thought process and imagining. Imagine this scenario. You're in a crowd of people, and you've just heard what I said, the story and the words following. And there's a young adult beside you who turns to you and sees a cross around your neck. And this young adult says, "Oh, I see you're a Christian, a follower of Jesus. How do Christians, as a Christian, how do you respond to this situation? How do you even think about it?" Imagine some, I mean, this is someone who's sincerely asking you. Can you take a minute just to think how you could respond? Imagine that just happened. Take a minute to talk to the person beside you. What came to your mind, and how would you respond? Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm going to interrupt again. Okay, friends. Ding dong! I mean, if we had 2 hours, we'd talk more. But what did someone that you talked with come up with? Thoughts?
I think as a Christian, we need to find answers to how to deal with this problem. That's our responsibility.
Why do you say that? Thank you. Why do you say that as Christians?
Well, that's for everybody. But as a Christian, I feel like that because we were told to take care of the earth. God created and our responsibility is to take care of it.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. What else did anyone come up with?
I can add to what she just said. Linda noted, yes, that we're called to break, care for all creation, but that seems to be an uncommon teaching.
An uncommon teaching. Okay, very interesting. So you think that that's one thing that maybe Christianity brings to the table?
I think it's definitely. I have difficulty actually understanding how people cannot see that. But I know that it's something that not all Christians necessarily embrace. Now, maybe people in this room do. But I think that, and you brought up something too that along the lines of he added that along the lines too of caring for all creation. There's this problem of local population as well, and that gets into all kinds of sticky. But just all kinds of difficulties. You know, monitoring and saying, okay, this this many children no more, or whatever, you know, in terms of population. But and then too, then brought up with that, the main point was that that was really tough to get all the different denominations, even within just Christianity, to agree upon. And then we come back full circle then to the issue of. I mean, I'm with you. I think most people in this room are probably are with you, but there are certainly a lot of people out there who don't. This would be news to them, kind of the creation.
Okay. Very good. That it would be news. Many people don't know about the ecological crisis.
I think it's changing. But I know that and I'm not trying to offend anybody here, but I think there is a tendency for certain denominations and certain. Expressions of Christianity to focus on certain things. And right now it seems as though for a period of time the more right side has been a little less ecologically, I'm being very kind here, but it's been a little less ecologically aware. That seems to be changing slightly.
It's a good point, and it's an interesting thing to think about for just a minute. One of the currently, and you're right, it's very recent changing, but the evangelical community came up about 10 years ago with something called the Evangelical Declaration on the Care of Creation. It has produced a wonderful book talking about it. It's called Care of Creation. The editor is Berry, B-E-R-R-Y. And the evangelical community is really starting to come forth and say this is part of our vocation as Christians. the Orthodox community, the Eastern Orthodox Church, the patriarch, the highest of the patriarchs of the Eastern Orthodox Church, has been profoundly involved, longer than any of the Protestant or Catholic denominations. He's the first high-level religious leader to declare environmental degradation as a sin. Mm-hmm. And so he publicly declared it as a sin. So we do see some of the religious community coming forth. I also thought that was interesting about what you said we're supposed to figure out, because we are the creatures with the, as far as we know at this point, the most sophisticated brains. So there is something about the power we have to figure out what to do in probably the most complex problem that's been faced since the humans came onto the planet.
And I think in addition to spreading the word about Christ to other people, I think it's our responsibility to enlighten people, especially anyone who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we have to kind of stop being us and them, you know, and start working on this problem together. Stop worrying about, you know, I was using it as an example, not intended to be divisive, but I think you make a good point too, that we just need to stop worrying about, we need to start working collaboratively here.
Okay, other hands that were up. I saw you haven't spoken yet.
I'm Peter. I think that what I would say to someone is that we need to listen more to other, either non-religious people or other religions, that the Native American folks figured this out quite a while ago, how to do it, and that we sort of need to get off this, we can figure it out, we can do it. Yes, we will be able to do that, but I think we need to absorb an awful lot from other folks before we jump in and say,
okay, let me speak to that for just a minute, too. We'll talk further about that, about learning wisdom from people on the margins of society historically. I'm going to throw out another little piece in relationship to what you just said. I'm going to suggest, and particularly in one of our later sessions, that humans might also need, and I ground this in Bible, to start listening to other than human parts of creation. And we'll talk about, from a biblical perspective, we're called to listen to the testimony of the mountains, etc. And is that something that we need to develop the ability to do? There were a couple of people who hadn't said anything yet. You didn't say anything. Okay.
The question evokes a response. I mean, the question is, what does it mean of this cross in the midst of this crisis? Well, the cross has to do with Jesus Christ. So to me, it really draws us to take a look at Jesus himself and what kind of testimony and witness he gave us for the care of the earth. He chose a life of voluntary simplicity. He advocated for sabbatical practices throughout, and he told people to put down their arms and said, fighting is not part of my reign.
And you connect that to?
And all of those things, if we would simply comply with those three dimensions of Jesus' testimony and witness, we wouldn't be in the situation we are today.
Okay, so you're saying, turn to Jesus, and what can Jesus teach in those three things?
I mean, what's unique about the cross that I'm wearing in relationship to Buddhism or Confucianism? I mean, we have to go to Jesus if we're going to answer the question.
That's the unique thing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, interesting, okay. Okay, good point. He is my husband, but good point anyway. Yes, hello.
I think maybe another thing is that we can say that we need to see everyone as our neighbor. Because part of why we think this is okay is because we see levels of society. And so we think we have some kind of right to more than our share. So that's because we don't see everybody as our neighbor, who is equal in God's eyes to ourselves.
Does anyone, that's very interesting. I mean, I think there's real truth in that. I think on a certain level, unconscious, we do tend to, I mean, I think I can confess to that. I think on some level, a part of me thinks that somehow I do have the right to have what I have, when maybe 1,000, I mean, a whole mass of hungry people on some other continent somehow quite don't have that same right or need. I'm not saying I think that consciously, but how else could I accept it? I mean, that there may be something there that we somehow think that we do. Yes.
Well, a couple of things on that. I mean, when we talk about solving this problem, we could just get together, we could solve this problem. We don't have to start at the beginning of the creation of the wheel. There's a lot of people and ideas that are already out there. But I think when I hear people in the readings that I do and in discussions that I've been in, saying, well, you know, we could just get together on this, we could just talk about these problems, we could come to solutions. Like, well, we have to come to our acceptances of some things we're going to have to sacrifice about the way we live. We don't. It's not about solving the problem. We have the tools. It's about the will to solve these problems. It's about accepting justice. It's not about charity, about giving away and doing a good thing. It's about justice and making things more equal. And that's going to require sacrifice on the part of those of us who have.
Well, in a sense, that's an extraordinarily hopeful statement to say we have the knowledge. And that's I think that's a very profound statement that as a species, we do have the knowledge that we need. To undo both the wealth gap and the ecological crisis, what it takes is the will. And in theological terms, let's think again as that will we can maybe think of as the moral agency, the moral power to enact, to work with what we know to get to where we need to be. I'm going to suggest that we are called to bring the gifts, some of which you've all talked about, of Christian traditions to this great interfaith and pan-human work of our era. Thomas Berry says there's a great work of every era, and ours is to forge a way to live sustainably with the planet and decrease this gap. And that we only Christians, can bring the gifts of the Christian traditions to this. If we don't, no one will. Others can bring the gifts of the Buddhist tradition or the Hindu tradition, but we can only, if we don't plumb the depths of our tradition, nobody will. I think one of the questions before, and I think this is, I'll say maybe the primary task of the church in our day, to respond to this, to what do we bring as Christians to the table of forging this future for the humankind. I'm going to suggest in these five sessions that we look at a particular question, and that is, that is this question of what new Christians bring? What can we bring? And I'd like to suggest that we think about what kind of theology, what theological characteristics, what dimensions of what we believe can enable us, the uncreators and the rich in a hungry world, to enter into that great work. What can enable us to resist economic inequity and ecological degradation and build toward abundant life for all? What are the theological resources that we have? Now, that's a huge question, and there's no way we can play with it in 5 hours. So I'm going to throw out one answer for us to explore and then leave that to many questions. And that is, I'm going to suggest that one of the things we need and have is an adequate theology of neighbor love, an adequate understanding of what it means to love neighbor as self. That if we explore that basic vocation, we get a fundamental thing that we need. And I'm going to suggest that an adequate understanding of neighbor love will be, and I think this is far more faithful to Jesus, not just interpersonally, not just what I do as a person, be it to help interpersonally, and not just feelings or interpersonal, but that love is, in fact, from a biblical perspective, it's a political and an ecological calling. And I'll talk more about what I mean by political. I don't mean party politics there. I don't mean party politics. I mean more the classic sense of the political. But that love is a political and ecological calling, not only an interpersonal calling. And I'm going to suggest that an adequate understanding of neighbor love also calls for an adequate theology of the cross. Is that a term that's somewhat familiar to people, theology of the cross? I work in a lot of ecumenical circles, and Lutherans are always known for one thing. They've got a theology of the cross. That means they think about what the cross of Christ means and grapple with that. And I think that the theology of the cross is connected with our understanding of neighbor love. And that would we dig into and dwell upon those, we bring infinite gold to the table of how to deal with this work of our day. I think that both of those things depend upon who we understand that we are. So that's one of the things we'll question. Who are we? What is a human being? But primarily, we're going to look at, in this context, what would be an adequate understanding of love thy neighbor as thyself. And as I said, a political ecological calling. I'd like to give you, we only have 7 minutes left. Is that clock right? Can anybody tell me?
It is?
Okay. Nope.
12 minutes after.
It's 12 minutes after?
I don't know. Well, let's pretend I'm eight.
Mine says it's a little more. I want to give you a little sense of the next four sessions. So in the second session, we're going to work on the norm of neighbor love itself. What does neighbor love mean? What does it mean to love neighbor itself? Martin Luther has tons to say on this, but we'll look at not just him. We'll look at what does neighbor love mean. And the third session, we're going to look at many of the forces, the subtle forces, be they beliefs, be they ideas, be they whatever, that lure us, that seduce us away from loving neighbor. And how do we overcome those forces? I've believed for a long time that one of the ways to deal with things that pull at us is to name them. You know, be they psychological or whatever, things that pull at us, to name them so that we can deal with them. So we're going to look at naming some of the forces that lure us away from neighbor love. And then in the fourth session, I'd like us to look at what I think is the greatest moral trap of our day. And that's the trap of not seeing reality clearly, not seeing what's going on around us. And we'll talk more about that, talk about the nature of structural sin, not just individual sin. But I call it the difficult and dangerous art of seeing. It's the book I'm working on right now. It's called Christian Ethics, The Difficult and Dangerous Art of Seeing. So I want to talk with us about the role of seeing what's going on. I call it mystical seeing and critical seeing. Finally, on the fifth day, dig more specifically into the ecological dimensions of neighbor love. Neighbor love not as only a political virtue, but an ecological virtue. We'll be building that in the whole time, but I want to work more heavily on it on the fifth day. Throughout, we'll nurture a greater sense of us being, we're all children of modernity. We're modern beings. We think of ourselves as primarily individuals, but it's only for the last 500 years that people have thought that way. Before, we've thought of ourselves, people thought of themselves as interrelated with others, profoundly interrelated, like fundamentally, ontologically. We're going to think about ourselves more as in communion with the rest of humankind, but beyond that, in communion with the whole web of life. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, our dear old Martin Luther, you never know it, but he says things like, God is present in every creature. God is present in all things, even the tiniest leaf. That's Luther. Did you ever hear that from Luther before? So if God's present in a leaf or all creatures, then there's some profound communion we have that is not only with other human beings, but with all creatures. So we're going to nurture those senses. I'm looking at that clock. I'm doing my best here. Two other things. One, I'm going to, I believe that the things I've just proposed are integrally a part of the foolishness of God. And let me say that in just a couple of ways. God is foolish enough to take a people in bondage to sin. We can't escape sin. You said earlier about how we're our self-interest is in the forefront of our mind. Martin Luther says we're bounded in. Even as societies, we see ourselves first. God is foolish enough to take this people that manages to become, through the fall or whatever, in bondage to sin, and then make a covenant with us. And God, in baptism, we say God makes a covenant with us, and that means God makes the promise to us. And then we say that we will promise to abide within the covenant that God made with us in holy baptism. And the last of the things we say, we'll do five things. One of them is seek justice and peace in all the earth. So this is a foolish God. Because a people in bondage to sin, he makes a covenant with, that you will serve all people in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, in the manner of our Lord Jesus Christ, and seek justice and peace in all the earth. You got to wonder about this deity. God is foolish enough in the cross and resurrection to promise us that the principalities and powers, and now I see the principalities and powers in part in relationship to that which creates this ecological crisis within us, to say that the principalities and powers will not win. The end of the story is life. Now, if you read some scientists, that's not the end of the story today. That's a foolishness of God. God is foolish enough to ask us, in spite of all evidence to the contrary, to trust God that that is so. Okay, look at the 20th century, the bloodiest century in humankind. If you look at the 20th century, and then you look at the wealth gap, and then you look at the ecological crisis, believing God's promise that ultimately abundant life for all will reign, I think a foolish God is calling us into the same reckless foolishness. And I think that's what we're all talking about. I believe all those things, by the way. I believe that abundant life will reign, and that's the promise of the cross. So we're going to try to connect that, or well, we're not going to try to. It's intimately connected, these ways of a God that must have a sense of profound foolishness to make those contradictions exist and then make the promises that exist in the face of them. Finally, I'd like to issue a little bit of homework, only if you want to do it, like no groans, no moans, nothing, only if you want to do it. And it's partly in preparation for something we'll do later on, but you could do it even if you weren't coming later on. And there are two options. And one is a plant journal. And what I would like you to think about for that is finding some plant, piece of growing thing. It could be a tree, it could be some other growing thing that's going to be there for the next few days. And give it 5 minutes a day and sit down very, very quietly beside it. And then let a conversation emerge between you and the plant. Just see what happens. And I say that because, I mean, I'm not being wooey-wooey or you know, wetty-wetty. I've got a lot of sophisticated intellectual work that's gone on in my life, and I'm convinced that we need to hear from the other-than-human parts of creation. So I try to devise ways to start to do that. And I think, so each day sit by the same thing, the same growth. It could be a piece of moss, it could be anything, and just take a little piece of paper and see what emerges in conversation with this living thing. Or the other option is to, it's called a seeing log. Go someplace and close your eyes. Just sit there for a minute and close your eyes. And then pretend that you're going to open them and being on a different planet. Like no place you've ever been before. Did anyone read the C.S. Lewis's trilogy? At one point, this happened in the trilogy. That's why I thought of it. These guys are on a different planet. And they see the incredible beauty, the fruits hanging from trees. So I want you to pretend you open your eyes and you're on a different planet and use all your senses. And what do you see? And then what do you hear? And what do you feel on your skin? And what do you smell? And just do that for 5 minutes, and then journal whatever comes to you. You might want to record what you see and smelled and heard and felt. Do you hear what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And try doing that for about 5 minutes a day for 5 days. And see what you discover. What you discover about the world around you that you might not have known before. And you could certainly do both of those, but those are something that I'm hoping everyone would choose one of to do. Any questions before we close?
Yeah, I'd also just make a plug that the plant idea I love. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really fun idea. And tomorrow, Bob Lee, who's the forester in the village, is doing a forest walk and going to just talk about what he sees in the health of the forest. And that'd be a really interesting way to just maybe choose something that you wouldn't choose.
Yes.
You know, maybe look through his eyes to choose a place that you might not have been before.
Oh, I love that idea.
That in as a thought.
I love that idea. Or you could revise the homework. You could decide to just very listen very quietly as you go through the plant, the tree walk, the forest walk, and hear what conversation emerges between you and the trees. That's a very good idea. I also wanted to note that we'll be talking about a theology of the cross, because I said that's integral to love. And one of the other people teaching this week, Merritt Trelstad, is working singularly on theology of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be interesting to see how, to visit her sessions and these, and see how they connect. That's another thing just to toss out there as a possibility. Okay, I'm so sorry it's only an hour. It's so much fun to talk together and think together and muse about these things, but I'm just delighted to have had the chance to be with you a little bit, and we'll carry on.
Thank you.